It was a year ago today that the government began planning the takeover of AIG to prevent the collapse of this, the largest insurance company in the world. Just about everyone seemed outraged that taxpayers had to save a private company. Congress vowed to rewrite the rules of American finance to prevent any bailouts in the future. Democrats and Republicans will now spend much of the fall battling over regulatory changes. Adam Davidson and Alex Bloomberg from NPR's Planet Money team have discovered that getting Republicans and Democrats to agree is sometimes the easy part.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the nightmare that is regulatory reform, a world where even universal consensus means nothing.
Pretty much everyone agrees, the Democrats or Republicans, we have too many regulators, just way too many. We should merge a bunch of them.
That's right. Take AIG. They were watched over by 400 different agencies around the world, dozens in the U.S., and nobody noticed that the company was on the verge of taking down the entire global economy.
This problem we're talking about, it has a name. Economists call it regulatory arbitrage. That's when more than one regulator oversees the same kind of activity. Financial firms always find a way to play one of them off against the other.
It's like what every four-year-old has figured out. If mommy won't let you, maybe daddy will.
Or worse, if mommy thinks daddy is watching you and daddy thinks mommy is watching you, well, you can get away with just about anything.
So, Adam, there's something else Democrats and Republicans agree on. The simple solution to this problem of regulatory arbitrage is never going to happen. Take one of the most glaring examples, the bizarre division of labor between the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the CFTC, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
You know those exchanges where you see all the traders yelling at each other, buying and selling stocks or pork belly futures or whatever? That's what these guys regulate. And they divide things in a weird way. If you buy and sell stocks, your overseer is the SEC. If you buy and sell stock index futures and other things that take place in the future, you get the CFTC.
Much of this crisis is linked to all sorts of strange financial products that fell between the cracks of the SEC and the CFTC.
Jeb Hensarling, a Republican congressman from Texas who is one of the staunchest free market advocates, says this makes no sense. Merge them into one. That way, none of these financial products get overlooked.
Barney Frank, the Democrat from Massachusetts, the ideological opposite of Jeb Hensarling, he agrees.
Obviously, we all know now, anybody, that it would have been better not to have had two separate entities. It would be better to have just one. It is now and will be politically impossible to put the two together.
See what we mean? Barney Frank is one of the most powerful people in Congress when it comes to financial reform issues. He wants the SEC and the CFTC to merge. He says so all the time. And he is one man who knows better than anybody why it never will.
Actually, Adam, there's this one other guy who might know even better than Barney Frank.
Barney doesn't want to fight that fight. And he saw what I went through and he just figured it's just not worth it. And I think he's probably right.
This is Mike Oxley. He used to have Barney Frank's job as chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. The Financial Services Committee oversees one of these two agencies that we're talking about, the SEC.
Oxley was a Republican representative from Ohio. He says this crazy system of two agencies looking over the same thing comes out of ancient financial history. The SEC was created to look over stock traders, who were mostly in New York. The CFTC started life as a different agency to look over the activities of farmers trading grain futures, mostly in Chicago.
These grain traders loved their regulator, which lived in a basement of the Department of Agriculture. They saw it as friendly and easy to work with, and they fought every effort from the larger New York-focused SEC to come to town and watch over things, which is why the CFTC today is still overseen by the Agriculture Committee.
Over the last 30 years, it's been harder to tell the difference between securities in New York and futures in Chicago, most of which today have nothing to do with grain or anything that comes from farms. But as former Financial Services Committee Chair Mike Oxley discovered, once you create two agencies, it's really hard to convince them to merge into one.
Oxley tried in the early 2000s and got nowhere, which he's sure is just where Barney Frank would get if he tried to do it as well.
Basically, you could go to the speaker and the speaker would say, are you out of your mind? And that would be the end of it, which is exactly what I did.
Right.
But I knew it was an uphill battle to begin with, and so I just had some people close to me in leadership and went to them, and I got the word. So, I mean...
You mean you went to other people, like the...
Oh, sure.
And they said, forget it, pal. Don't fight this.
Pretty much, yeah.
So one question. Why is this a fight? Why are people battling over the right to regulate financial futures? We got some insight on this from Ben Nighthorse Campbell, who's a good person to talk to about this. He was in the House and the Senate on the Banking and Agriculture Committees. And in fact, he was a Democrat and a Republican at different points in his career.
He said, imagine if the Speaker of the House takes one of these two agencies away from a committee chairman. That chairman would be really miserable.
He loses a group that may be very interested in getting him reelected, as an example.
I see.
Which it relates to, money for reelection and all kinds of stuff, votes for reelection.
And is it as straightforward as I want that group of lobbyists to keep giving me money?
Nope. I think it's much more subtle than that.
You can look at this whole thing really cynically. If I'm a committee chairman, I don't want to give up those big donations from lobbyists.
Or you can look at it just sort of cynically. The more a chairman oversees, the bigger the budget he gets, the more staff, the nicer office, cooler congresspeople want to be on his committee, it's easier to trade favors in exchange for votes that benefit his constituents.
Or dare we say it, you can look at this really idealistically. The more you oversee, the more power you have to make the world a better place.
The point is, whatever kind of congressperson you are, you want to hold on to your jurisdiction. Which means the way Congress works, it's almost impossible to end regulatory arbitrage.
Even right now, 1 year after regulatory arbitrage helped cause that huge financial crisis, Mike Oxley says trying to merge those agencies is like beating a dead horse.
Worse than beating a dead horse.
That horse is not only dead, but it's been dissected and ground up for horse meat. Give it up.
Once you give up, you can have peace with it.
Just like I'm never going to beat Tiger Woods, all right? I've come to terms with that issue.
What do you think's more likely, that you'll beat Tiger Woods or the CFTC and the SEC will merge?
Oh, I'll beat Tiger Woods before the CFTC and the SEC are merged, yeah.
A few months ago, Barney Frank and Colin Peterson, the chairman of the Financial Services Committee and the Agriculture Committee, announced that the SEC and the CFTC would stay separate. But they'd all work together more closely.
And this month, the two agencies held their first ever joint meeting, complete with all sorts of finance experts, to discuss ways to prevent financial products from slipping through the cracks.
And at that very meeting, some of those experts said, hey guys, you shouldn't be two agencies talking about working together. You should merge. You should be one. I'm Alex Blumberg.
And I'm Adam Davidson, NPR News, New York.
And you can find more of our financial crisis series at npr.org. While you're there, catch up on the latest economic news in our Planet Money blog. The global economic crisis has taught lessons that reach far beyond Wall Street. Back in February, the U.S. Director of National Intelligence said the financial turmoil had replaced terrorism as the number one threat to the nation's security. The economic panic may have subsided, but its effects linger. NPR's Tom Gelton reports on how the crisis has elevated the importance of economic issues on the national security agenda.
Here are some connections between the economy and security. A subprime mortgage crisis in the United States can lead to social unrest in the developing world. When financial markets freeze and the global economy stalls, so does the flow of money from rich nations to poor nations. Another example, dependence on debt financing from potential adversaries leaves the U.S. vulnerable to economic warfare. The U.S. official responsible for tracking these connections is Michael Froman. He's both a deputy national security advisor under General James Jones and a deputy to Larry Summers, the president's economic advisor.
I report jointly to General Jones and Larry Summers, as does my staff. We work equally for both of them. There are some issues that have more of a national security component and some issues that have less of a national security component, and sometimes that points us towards one boss more than another, but we work jointly for both.
Froman advises security colleagues on the geopolitics of economic events. At the National Economic Council, meanwhile, he specializes in those economic issues that have a foreign policy dimension.
Actions taken at home to stimulate the economy or to repair the financial sector or to reform the regulatory regime all have international implications and require international concerted action.
Froman gets help from the CIA. Since February, the agency has been preparing a daily economic intelligence brief for him and a handful of other U.S. officials. The EIB, as it's called, is a direct outgrowth of the global financial crisis. It's separate from the more famous President's Daily Intelligence Brief and focuses exclusively on economic issues. One recent brief, for example, reported secret data on supply and demand issues in the global oil market. Richard Cooper is a Harvard economics professor who chaired the government's National Intelligence Council in the mid-90s. He says the CIA might tell policymakers, for example, what the Chinese appear to be doing with the trillion-plus U.S. dollars they hold as part of their currency reserves.
China has been very secretive about how they hold their reserves. If the Chinese were to begin moving their reserves, the intelligence community could find out at least as quickly as the markets notice it, perhaps more quickly.
Another example, several countries, including Russia, have so-called sovereign wealth funds, basically huge state-owned investment funds. Cooper says many of those countries hire private fund managers, but the CIA could do some secret digging to find out more.
What instructions are given to the private managers exactly, you know, just maximize returns or stick it to the Americans, we have an interest in. That's an area where some of our sources and methods could be helpful in giving us advance warning if somebody wanted to make trouble.
A senior intelligence official who helps write the daily EIB won't say whether it discusses currency transactions or sovereign wealth funds. He does say the vast majority of the agency's economic intelligence reports do involve secret information. A monthly economic vulnerability review, for example, lists the countries in serious economic trouble. Such reporting became more important in the last year. Michael Froman says the economic crisis showed that the group of eight industrialized countries can't solve economic problems alone. Froman looks instead to the larger G20, which includes China, India, and other rising economies. There is a new geopolitical lineup.
The G20 reflects that. It's been very effective in mobilizing concerted action. And it does reflect a different approach to global governance.
Froman is the Obama administration's point man for the G20 meeting in Pittsburgh later this month. He'll draw on the CIA's economic intelligence briefs. The intelligence official who helps write them is ready. When U.S. officials go into negotiations, he says, they look to the intelligence community to tell them what the others are bringing to the table. That, he says, is something we do. A new type of spy work for a changing world. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Steve Inskeep is on assignment. I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. President Obama is calling on lawmakers to approve new rules for the financial sector before the end of this year. He made that appeal on Wall Street yesterday in a speech marking the first anniversary of Lehman Brothers' collapse. The president said the financial industry needs strong new rules of the road, as he put it, to prevent a repeat of last year's meltdown. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Memories on Wall Street and in Washington can be short, so President Obama opened his speech by recalling the frantic days surrounding Lehman Brothers' bankruptcy, when the U.S. seemed in danger of tumbling into another Great Depression.
Other large firms teetered on the brink of insolvency. Credit markets froze as banks refused to lend not only to families and businesses, but to one another. $5 trillion of Americans' household wealth evaporated in the span of just 3 months.
It was against that backdrop that first the Bush administration and later Mr. Obama's own ordered extraordinary federal actions to prop up the financial sector. Hundreds of billions of dollars were committed. And a year later, Mr. Obama said, the financial system has begun to stabilize.
After months in which public dollars were flowing into our financial system, we're finally beginning to see money flowing back to taxpayers.
Some of the banks that receive government support have repaid the money with interest. By last month, the administration felt confident enough that no additional bank bailouts would be needed. It removed the $250 billion set aside for that purpose in its budget. But just because the panic has subsided, Mr. Obama said, there's no reason for bankers to fall back into the bad habits that toppled Lehman Brothers and jeopardize the broader economy.
We will not go back to the days of reckless behavior and unchecked excess that was at the heart of this crisis, where too many were motivated only by the appetite for quick kills and bloated bonuses.
3 months ago, the Obama administration proposed a sweeping overhaul of financial regulations. Its plan would give the Federal Reserve increased authority to police big financial firms, and it would create a new agency to regulate mortgages and other kinds of consumer loans. Travis Plunkett of the Consumer Federation of America calls that change overdue. He says until now, protecting consumers has not been a high priority for any of the existing financial regulators.
If we've learned anything from this crisis, it's that consumer protection shouldn't be an afterthought. It should be front and center. No federal agency has as its job only to protect consumers.
But the idea of stripping consumer protection functions away from the existing regulators and assigning them to a new agency is controversial. Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable, which represents big financial firms, says it would just mean more regulators, each armed with less information.
We think that the fate of the consumers and the products they purchase and that of the bank are inextricably linked. And so it's better, it's more effective to have one regulator overview to regulate both.
That's one of several disputes Congress will have to wrestle with. Mr. Obama spoke inside New York's historic Federal Hall, where he noted Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton debated the government's role in the economy some two centuries ago. While that debate continues, the president said, the country does not have to choose between a completely unfettered financial market and one that's tied in knots by regulation.
Common sense rules of the road don't hinder the market. They make the market strong. Indeed, they are essential to ensuring that our markets function fairly and freely.
The administration wants Congress to adopt those new rules before the painful lessons of the last year slip too far into history. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke said it again today, the recession is very likely over. But the costs remain from the worst economic collapse since the Great Depression. The U.S. government committed trillions, propping up banks, rescuing U.S. automakers, and providing credit for everything from mortgages to small business loans. We've been looking back at the financial crisis of 1 year ago, and we asked NPR's John Itzdeep to take on the big question, what's it all going to cost?
Totaling up the cost of the government's effort to rescue the U.S. economy is a bit daunting. It depends on a lot of things. How fast the economy recovers, how many banks pay back the Treasury's TARP money, how much the Fed will get for the dicey mortgage-backed securities it bought from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's daunting, but Princeton economist Alan Blinder, former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve, has this educated guess.
Hundreds of billions, I would say. I have a hard time guessing what the first digit in that is going to be.
Mm-hmm. More likely above or below 5, do you think?
I think more likely below.
So less than $500 billion. And what's going to swallow the biggest billions?
I think a couple of places where big losses are going to come is the auto bailout, AIG, which is we're already in for like $180 billion. It's hard to imagine getting that money back. Fannie and Freddie.
The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office generally agrees with Blinder's assessment. It hasn't made an official estimate of the cost, but in its August update, the CBO predicts the Treasury's TARP program that rescued banks, auto companies, and homeowners will lose more than $200 billion. And it estimates the takeover of Fannie and Freddie could cost almost $400 billion. That would put the total cost of the bailout at $600 billion, slightly higher than Blinder's estimate. Now, you might be thinking, well, what about the trillions the Federal Reserve has committed to the rescue? Well, the CBO suggests that the Fed's activities may not cost taxpayers anything. Vincent Reinhardt, a former Fed official who is now at the American Enterprise Institute, agrees.
I think the direct cost to the taxpayers of the Federal Reserve's involvement in markets is not going to be very big.
That's because the Fed's activities involve lending, not spending. And the Fed requires collateral for its loans. Some of the collateral isn't worth much, but the Fed is charging fees and interest on the trillions it's lent. That income is likely to offset any losses. But what about the $100 billion the FDIC may have to put up to rescue failing banks? Well, the FDIC's first line of defense is its insurance pool funded by premiums from the banks. But that's running out of money, so taxpayers will likely have to step up, just as they did during the S&L crisis of 20 years ago, says Alan Blinder.
The taxpayer basically fronted the money, and then the FDIC levied gradual assessments on banks over probably around a decade and a half. to pull that money back in to the funds. I would guess something like that happens again.
The CBO makes a similar assessment, so the taxpayers may not lose money from the FDIC's activities either. If you total it up, the bailout, the cost of rescuing the financial system, could run taxpayers around $600 billion. But sad to say, that's not the whole bill. Again, Alan Blinder.
The bigger cost is the net loss to the economy of this recession, which is in the trillions. People should remember that.
As President Obama said yesterday, there's the bailout and then there's the fallout, the cost of the longest, deepest recession since the Great Depression. The first thing to consider here is the nearly $800 billion stimulus package enacted to fight the recession. Add in another $200 billion to pay higher unemployment and food stamp benefits, and you're pushing $1 trillion. Put together those fallout costs and the bailout costs, and the total bill for taxpayers is likely to be more than $1.5 trillion. Now, I wish I could stop here. But you can't ignore the trillions of dollars of wealth that evaporated as homes and retirement accounts plummeted in value. Of course, some of that will be restored as the markets move higher and the economy starts growing again. But Mohammed El-Erian, the CEO of the big investment firm PIMCO, says don't expect a quick return to the heady days of a few years ago.
In this new world, what we call the new normal, economies will grow less rapidly. It's going to take a long time to work ourselves out of this crisis. And therefore, the ability of the U.S. economy to create jobs is going to be less than it has been in the past.
And among those hurt most will be young people, says El-Erian.
And I think of that every day when I look at my daughter in terms of what her generation is going to inherit because of this crisis.
In addition to a tougher time finding jobs, the next generation will likely face rising taxes or higher inflation if the country chooses to simply add the cost of this crisis to the national debt. El-Erian says Americans will also pay a price for the world's loss of confidence in American markets. Those costs could haunt the United States for years to come. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.